The woman you're about to meet gets people talking, often about things they've never articulated before. First it was men, then it was girls, but lately she's been talking to boys. For her latest project, Maggie Hamilton spoke to 50 boys, as well as many other people concerned about their lives, and her conclusions are, well, troubling. Maggie Hamilton joins me now to talk about a new book, What's Happening to Our Boys. Hello, Maggie. Welcome back.
Hi. Great to be with you again, Richard.
You've immersed yourself in the world of boys.
I have.
Slugs and snails and puppy dogs' tails. But that's not what you found, is it?
No, it isn't. And I think I feel sorry for our boys, because I think the boys in the 21st century have a kind of double layer of things to deal with. I think we didn't get a lot of stuff right for them in terms of their nurture and making them genuinely strong and independent before the 21st century issues hit. So I kind of see them almost as doubly vulnerable, but not because there's anything wrong with them, but just because we don't always get them, I think.
21st century issues, you're saying? What specifically?
Well, everything from, the cyberbullying to the porn to, you know, dealing, how does a young boy grow up in this hypersexualized climate and have very clear ideas about what's appropriate, what's not, about his own sexual expression and so forth. And also just the very emotionally complex world in which our boys have to navigate as they grow.
Well, we'll come back to some of the specifics. But what surprised you most about the conversations you had with the boys? Because it's a very conversationally driven exercise, isn't it?
Yes, and I really wanted to try and capture that intimate experience of what it's like to be a boy growing up in the 21st century. What surprised me is that so often people will say, you know, oh, boys, you know, they're so inarticulate, you know, and that's not what I found. I found them remarkably articulate. What surprised me was how tender they are often. When you get behind that attitude, which can be quite confronting and certainly challenging, is actually just a young kid trying to grow up in a complex society. And that's when you see the nuanced tenderness, I'd say, of boys, where they are feeling all the same feelings that girls are, but they're not really allowed to give that expression. So that all kinds of gets hidden away.
There's a paradox here, isn't there? Because they're all feeling it. But, of course, they don't show it to each other much.
They don't. Or to parents often. So that makes it very hard, I think, for parents often to read the signals. And certainly with each other, it's not very nuanced at all often.
No, indeed. Well, let's talk about parents. What did they say about their mums first?
This was really lovely. Their mums are absolutely critical to their lives. And I think this is a really special message, because I think a lot of mums, as boys grow, fear almost that they're a contaminating influence on their boys, in terms of if they're too close to mum, that they might end up being a wuss and not being able to really navigate life. They very specifically, they felt that often mums were the parent that they could have the extended talks to, that they could talk about stuff that was difficult, except sex. And they often didn't like the idea of talking to mum about sex. Very much the person who they can talk to about their goals and their dreams. Mm. I mean, one 11-year-old boy said to me, would you believe, he said, the thing about mums is that they give your dreams wings. How lyrical is that?
Mm.
So, yes, those kind of tender aspects of life and how you navigate your social life and those things and what's kind of actually going on behind the scenes when things go pear-shaped, mums are really brilliant at. Also, practical things, which some mums might roll their eyes up, others might laugh, is food, that they actually saw...
They're very food-focused,
aren't they?
They're
very food-focused, and they saw that as a very profoundly nurturing thing. And I think actually that's so. I think we all experience that in situations where we feel loved and we're with people we love. It actually almost, it is a feeding of the spirit.
Now, what about their dads? Because this is interesting. They want them, it seems to me from looking at the book,
that
they want dads to be there. They want them to be up to speed with the issues and the world they're facing.
Yeah.
They don't want them to try and be their best mate, though.
No. And I think this is a really important message for dads, because I think dads have kind of taken a back seat for all sorts of reasons and not necessarily felt that they're terribly relevant to their boys. But their boys really relish that opportunity to hang out with dad and to kind of understand masculinity as they grow, almost by osmosis, by hanging around, watching what dad does, what he
says.
Because
they're the first example, aren't
they?
Absolutely. They're not the only one, and they clearly need more than one.
They clearly do, but dad is the first kind of bridge to the adult world. And, you know, the fathers who would sit down and explain stuff and would have one-on-one time, those boys were tracking incredibly well, were very clear about themselves and their world. And but those, the boys who didn't have dads around or had friends who didn't, actually used words a lot like sadness and how disappointing it was. And there was a real sense of an aching loss there. And I think this is something that we really need to understand. Even boys who had dads who were away for work a lot actually felt a kind of grief, believe it or not. But again, it depends what happens when dad comes home. I remember one boy I interviewed, his dad was, he was a rural doctor and would come back to the city at the weekends. And his dad was clearly really engaged with him and had really good one-on-one time. And he said to me, he said, I idolize my dad. And he said, you know, I just live for the weekends when we can have those talks. And, you know, dad comes with me to footy practice and all those things. And yet he was very much his own person. What they did find hard often with dad was in the goal-seeking area, you know, boys having their dreams about what they might do in life, that a lot of boys said that dads tended to slap them down by being either hypercritical or almost too practical, like, oh, well, you know, you're never going to do that for, you know, these 10 reasons. And so that's why they would tend to go to mum to talk about those things.
Right, the nicer parent. On Life Matters today, if you've just joined us, we're talking about what's happening to our boys with the author Maggie Hamilton. Maggie's got this gift for getting people talking to her. She's talked to a lot of boys and the people who care about them for this latest effort. Perhaps this has always been so, and I think it has in a way, but boys are often seen as troublesome and problematic.
Yeah.
And you say this leaves boys feeling as if they have to apologise for being boys. Is that the feeling you picked up in the conversations?
Definitely. And I think it's something that we've all been guilty of, we women. You know, those kind of offhanded jokes about, you know, how stupid men are or dangerous men, that kind of thing.
There's a lot of that now in popular culture. There's stuff in advertising about that.
Definitely.
And it's funny.
Yes.
But
it's funny if you're not a young boy growing up who, you know, the message young boys get is that actually it's not actually brilliant to be a boy. You know, it would have been much better perhaps to have been a girl or whatever. But I think we don't often understand how corrosive those jokes can be. You know, the kind of jokes that are told at the family barbecue and around the kitchen table.
Even jokes about men too, I wonder. I mean, because there's now this sort of, well, you know, men, I suppose they're good at lifting things. But they're, you know, they're kind of idiots really.
That's right.
There has been a bit of that.
Yeah. And the boys, the boys are very confused about what value they bring to things. And I don't think we give them a sense of usefulness enough. And that's why in the book I look at the boys who've actually been involved in service programs, either at school or in the neighborhood, and what a difference that brings to a boy's life, that they actually feel like they personally have something to contribute. It's a very powerful thing.
This is something that more and more schools are getting involved with, isn't
definitely
it? They're really, especially boys' schools.
Yeah.
They're trying to foster this sense of service to the community.
Yes, and I think that that is a very powerful thing for boys. So there was one teacher I spoke to in Adelaide, and she takes boys to Mother Teresa's, one of Mother Teresa's institutions in India, where they work with very severely intellectually and physically handicapped kids. And she said, look, the first day, these boys can't even be in the same room as the kids. By the end of the week, the kids are in their arms, they're feeding them out their hands. And she said, you get them to come back on the plane. They do other stuff as well while they're there, of course. And she said, you've got these big hulking 17-year-olds sobbing because she said there's something in that experience that liberates them very profoundly. And she said they come back, they often don't want Christmas presents, they are clear about the choices they can make and the fact they've got the privilege of education. So service can be very profound in a boy's life.
In a way, you do talk about And you've already touched on them, some of the areas in which boys have been problematic and some of the concerns about boys. So things like pornography and bullying and things like that. And there's a fair list of threats and dangers. Are you concerned that this might feed into the negativity that we've just...
Definitely. And it was a real challenge actually writing the book, Richard, because particularly around issues like pornography, it's really very serious. We're not only having kids at secondary school accessing porn, we're increasingly getting primary school kids accessing porn and sexual assault units experiencing grooming and abuse in primary school that they then have to deal with based on internet experiences. And I needed to be able to alert parents to that, but I didn't want to buy into this stereotype that, you know, all men are predators. And so I think that's what we each have to navigate in our own way is, you know, and parents have to obviously deal with this with good discussions, but be very positive because I think one of the problems is that we do tend to give kids the feeling that most of the stuff they do is rubbish and then we've kind of walked out of this golden age, and that's very unhelpful, and it's not the case.
And, I mean, there's no question that boys, just like girls growing up now, are marketed at from a much younger age.
Yes.
And that some of that marketing, especially as they get a bit older, is hypersexualized.
Absolutely. And this makes it extremely confusing for a young boy coming into his own understanding of as himself as a sexual being. Where do the boundaries lie? You know, what are the consequences? What is appropriate behavior? Because the behavior that's suggested in popular culture, the MTV clips, etc., and what mum and dad and perhaps wider society expect are hugely different.
So they're getting different grammars, if you like.
Totally different grammars. And somewhere in the middle of that, they have to kind of work out for themselves how they navigate these two worlds.
One school that you talked to had a dignity week.
Yeah, this is a local school in Sydney. And the whole idea was that it was really to get boys to understand about what happens when things go off the rails and how would you feel if that was your mom, your sister, and to get them to consciously think about choices they make. And it ended up with a kind of ceremony where mums were invited and was very, very powerful.
You don't pull any punches in this, Maggie. You say, I'll quote you, "We need to take charge of our boys' lives early to be fierce gatekeepers of what matters."
Yeah. And I say that, Richard, because I'm very concerned about things like the marketing, the fact that that children are marketed to so young, and that we are now seeing anxiety levels growing not only in the 6 to 12-year-olds, but preschool, and that by kids are getting to 6 and 7, they're actually having to go into formal counselling for things like anxiety and body image issues. And this is now boys as well as girls.
Is that related, though, to the rise of obesity? I was saying on the show the other day, there were maybe 3 fat kids in my primary school when I was at school. Now, of course, there's that many in most years.
There's the obesity issue, but it's also the marketing to kids, the images in ads wearing, you know, the right brand of gear, where kids are very conscious of what the right kind of look is in terms of hair, kind of how you wear your T-shirt, you know. And if you happen to be a kid who has different genes, don't necessarily have to be obese, but you might be very short or whatever, then that anxiety is starting very young.
Just anecdotally, and this has to be brief, I know a lot of 9 and 10-year-olds. My son is 10.
Yeah.
And, you know, a few of them have got their issues and they're not perfect, but they're good kids and I feel optimistic about them, that group.
Yeah. Look, I feel optimistic ultimately because otherwise, why bother? But I think it depends where kids are growing up in Australia and how much parents are actually buying into their lives.
All right, Maggie, I think that's a good point to wrap things up. Thanks very much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thanks, Richard.
That's Maggie Hamilton, who has succeeded in getting 50 boys to talk to us. She's the author of What's Happening With Our Boys. It's published by Penguin Viking. Keen to hear from you on this, of course, abc.net.au/rn/lifematters.